You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.
Welcome to today's Live Talk. I'm your host, Michelle Gasso. This week on the Corrections Connection, we're looking at pre-release planning for HIV-positive inmates. And joining us today to discuss this topic is Dr. David Wall, Clinical Assistant Professor, Division of Infectious Diseases for the Department of Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, and Co-Director of HIV Services for the North Carolina Department of Corrections. Wall is the author of several AIDS-related studies, articles, and publications, and has also given oral presentations on HIV and AIDS, most recently at the 10th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections in Boston earlier this year. He's also an associate editor of the HIV and Hepatitis Education Prison Project Report, which is published by Brown University. Welcome to today's live talk, Dr. Wall.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have you. This month on Corrections.com, we've been covering healthcare issues in corrections, and one of the major ones that agencies are talking about and addressing is pre-release planning for inmates who have health problems. And what we were hoping to talk a little bit about today is the importance of creating these connections to the community for HIV-positive inmates in particular, but maybe also you can talk about other communicable diseases as well.
Sure, and I think it's a very valid concern, both within corrections and within the community. You know, it goes sort of in the duh category, is that if you have people who are incarcerated for any length of time, removed from their communities, who have medical problems, especially those that are infectious, that there is an obligation to that individual. But also you can see it from a public health point of view, that it may make some really good sense to try to provide some continuity of care after release. People in prison generally in our country get pretty decent health care and dental care. Mm-hmm. When they go back out into the community, they don't get that. And for HIV, it's somewhat ironic that probably the only place in the United States where health care for HIV is guaranteed practically is inside of prisons. In the community, ADAPs are very variable. Some, like in my state, are shutting down and not allowing, periodically not allowing new applicants to get services. So, you know, again, it's a paradox, but these people get really good HIV care generally in prisons. And then to bring them back into the community and say, well, now you're on your own, especially in the beginning, I think is counterproductive. And our concern, my group here at UNC, is very concerned about the infectious potential of these people in addition to their own health. We want these people to be healthy, productive members of society, but we also don't want them to bring the virus back into their community. And of course, as everyone knows, these people, these individuals who come into prison and are detected to have HIV, you know, by and large, brought it into prison with them. They were infected prior to their incarceration. As opposed to the myth outside of our world where people think, you know, it's like Oz, everyone gets infected inside of prison. But, you know, in the community, I think that there are really some good data that people who've been incarcerated and have HIV are practicing risk behaviors that are really concerning.
Right. And that kind of leads me actually to my next question, which is some data that you've collected as part of a study of HIV-positive inmates, and I believe it was for pre- and post-releases you touched base with these folks. Can you talk to us about the study that you were involved in and who was studied? And
yeah, sure. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about people who are incarcerated and infectious diseases and all that sort of stuff, but there, unfortunately, is not really a lot of data. So one very fundamental question we had was, you know, do people who get out of prison practice risk behaviors? And so to get at that, it's kind of a hard question to answer. And so what we tried to do was sort of triangulate the period of time that people are out of prison. And to do that, we interviewed HIV-positive prisoners who were about to be released from prison, and we asked them about their sex lives before they were incarcerated, and the average incarceration was only about a year or two. So it really wasn't too far remote that these people were talking about, you know, their sexual experiences. And then we asked them what expectations they had when they got out of prison, and these very same people we actually followed up with about 45 days after they were released and said, well, tell me what's gone on since you've been out. Again, asking more explicit questions about intimate behaviors. In addition, a separate group of people who were recidivists, so HIV-positive people who were incarcerated, then released, and reincarcerated, on reincarceration, we asked them, you know, during the time that you've been out, tell us again about your sex lives. So there were two different groups of people, the pre-release people who were interviewed and then post-release, and then these recidivists. So about 160 people altogether, about half women. And largely African-American, pretty decent high school education, 92% unmarried. And what we found was fairly astonishing, more so than we even anticipated. And it showed that about three-quarters of the people who were interviewed before release and three-quarters of the recidivists, different group of people, but so 85 in each group about three-quarters had said they had unprotected sex with a sex partner during their last period of being non-incarcerated, you know, free.
And obviously these people knew they were HIV infected at the time.
More than three-quarters, well, the recidivists all knew that they were HIV positive when they were out, and they were out for over a year. And the people who were interviewed pre-release, again, about three-quarters, more than three-quarters, knew they were HIV infected before they were incarcerated, this incarceration. And more importantly, when we asked them, well, your partner, are they HIV infected or not? What do you think? About half said, my partner, I think it's negative. Generally, again, across the board, about a third of the people said it was likely or very likely they would infect their HIV-negative sex partner.
Wow.
When we talked to people 45 days after they got out of prison, so the pre-release people who finally got out, 45 days later, already a quarter of them had had unsafe sex with their main sex partner. And it's important to illustrate, you know, to focus on that main sex partner. There were an average of 8 other sex partners for each individual.
And did they say whether they had unprotected sex with them too?
They were more likely to have unprotected sex with their other sex partner than they were with their main sex partner for some of the group, and it was vice versa for others of the group. So it was very interesting, and that's something we're analyzing now. It actually seemed that for a lot of people, with their main sex partner, they were less likely to use condoms, maybe because of the intimacy that they had developed, you know, with that person and that relationship. And to, you know, just make sure, North Carolina, you know, is not Mongolia. We do a lot of counseling. We have HIV outreach nurses who counsel on transmission. So these people were fairly well-versed in how HIV is transmitted, and when we asked them about that, they were pretty savvy about that. So it wasn't a matter of ignorance that, you know, oh, well, no one ever told me I should use a condom when I have sex. People were pretty well educated regarding transmission, but they knew that they were practicing unsafe sexual behaviors.
Wow. Was it just sort of a... Were you able to get a sense of whether it was sort of a roll of the dice that they were kind of hoping that they weren't going to infect, or that they just it was a choice? Or
we don't know, and it's a really good question, because this was a little bit, I guess we anticipated some of this, but maybe not to this extent. And I think the next part of what we'll do is try to understand more about, you know, the partners and the people who were released, and try to understand more about what they were thinking about. You know, some of the partners obviously knew they were having sex with an HIV-infected person, uninfected partners, and, you know, what's going on with them? Is there just a nihilism that they have, that they just don't care? Is it that they just think, well, if I'm going to die of something, you know, that sort of mentality that we hear about a lot? So I think it's unclear exactly. We know it's happening, but we just don't know what people are thinking about. The important thing that I want to point out, though, is this is not an indictment of people who are HIV positive and former prisoners. Mm-hmm. When we look at our community clinic, we found some similar results. When we just talked to people who've not been incarcerated and asked about unsafe sex in the last year, about half of them that we interviewed in our clinic with the same survey answered the same way. That, you know, I'm not having safe sex with my sex partner. I haven't disclosed my HIV status to my other sex partners. Same sort of trends. Maybe not as many, although it's hard to compare group to group, but about half of our HIV clinic at UNC also responded that they are not practicing safe sex.
So it really sort of speaks to the importance of education and keeping up the continuity of care. And
I guess. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not one of these people that are going to come in and say, you know, if you can, you know, have a really great discharge planning program and if there's case management, all things are going to be rosy and wonderful.
Right.
I actually don't think so. Behavioralists will tell you behaviors are very hard to change, and intimate behaviors maybe in particular. So I think a lot of work has to be done, but I don't have, you know, rose-tinted glasses that are saying if we throw more money at the problem with more discharge planning and more education, that's going to work. Like I said, I think these people had education. I think the next thing that we have to find out about is what's going on in these people's minds. And
right.
Of course, I feel that there's a bigger picture here, and that is the communities to which these people are returning are not exactly pleasant all the time.
Yeah.
That there are a lot of other stressors going on, and that, you know, when you're worried about whether or not someone's going to sneak up behind you with a 9mm,
mm-hmm.
or whether or not you have a place to live, or you can care for your kids, whatever, HIV may not be the highest priority anymore. So I think that we're talking about people who live in, oftentimes, not always, but some people who live in a world that is hard for people who live outside of that world to understand.
Yeah.
And that, of course, has to affect how we look at that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. David Wall of the AIDS Research and Treatment Unit at UNC Chapel Hill about pre-release planning for inmates. I want to kind of continue on that vein that we were just talking of. You know, what kind of interventions, you know, should corrections agencies think about having the service centers who are being released? And you sort of said, well, maybe case management isn't going to be the silver bullet, but is it one of the options that folks have out there to use?
Yeah. I think that, you know, given what I said, I should qualify it. I don't mean that that means we shouldn't do anything. And I think certainly corrections has a stake in this, but I think it's even bigger, and I think states have to have a stake in this, and
mm-hmm.
that's going to be hard given the current environment, financial environment, economic environment. But what I'm talking about is that there have to be better linkages. There has to be some sort of bridging of the gap between incarceration and community entry or reentry. And most correctional systems, you know, they don't get money to take care of people when they're out of prison. Their charge is to keep people in prison, keep them safe, feed them, develop programs, take care of basic health care needs. They're not going to want or are able, generally, to provide any sort of services for people the day after they get out. And if we think about it more macroscopically, that corrections are part of the larger society and that the state that runs these correctional facilities might want to think about more of a global, holistic approach to health care for these people, and also public health, which I, again, want to stress over and over, that there might be motivation and justification for developing programs that help ease people into the community, that help educate them in a way that's different than here, you know, this is a pamphlet about how to put on a condom, but try to motivate people in a way that they come to conclusions by themselves about what's important in their lives and how important it is not to infect other people, sort of the epidemic, within the epidemic that's occurring within many of our communities, particularly African-American communities, and get people to really take a stake in trying to, you know, make their lives and the lives of those people they care about and who live around them better. Now, I don't think one correctional facility is going to be able to do that. One correctional system is not going to necessarily be able to do that. I think it's going to take buy-in from the correctional people, from the state legislatures, from the public health infrastructure, and that's a tall order. But it's happening in little ways. All over the country, people are, you know, coming up with the same conclusion. We need some sort of bridge, and that bridge can take many different flavors, depending upon, you know, what you're dealing with, whether or not you're in Arizona or Rhode Island or North Carolina.
I think you touched on an important point there with public health and getting sort of legislatures and states and localities to realize that it isn't really so much, I mean, in corrections is really taking care of the treatment end of it while people are incarcerated, but, you know, you have to kind of think about what's happening after, and obviously the public health is at risk if nothing is happening after. And you're right, there are some sort of pockets where public health agencies and corrections collaborations are happening. Do you think that more of those are going to happen then?
I think so. One thing I think we have to demonstrate to people, again, I think we're unfortunately in an economic environment where states are cutting back services, not implementing new programs or funding new programs. So I think it's going to be a while before these things get really are able to take off. Although, you know, the Rhode Island experience, which is, you know, worldwide renowned, they have a situation where they have had the buy-in from the state government that I think you really need. In our state, what we're trying to do is demonstrate that this works. I think if we have data that indicate, look, when we do have bridging between incarceration and community reentry, and we try to make an effort to make sure people that their well-being is generally taken care of, other things fall into place. Their health care falls into place. Their risk behaviors may change. And even if risk behaviors don't change markedly, if we could get people into care, get their viral load down, and thus the amount of virus they have in their genital secretions, we may render people less infectious. And most people, when we talk to them about that, are psyched about that. You know, yeah, that would be great. We try to make sure people don't look at it as a license to have unsafe sex, and it's, you know, careful pitching of this. But I think getting people into care, getting their virus load down, in and of itself, is a good thing to do for the person in public health. Couple that with some efforts for motivational behavioral change, and I think you might see numbers of transmission events decrease.
Well, that sounds like a plan. That concludes today's live talk. Thank you to Dr. David Wall of UNC Chapel Hill for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you to our audience for tuning in. For more information on healthcare issues and corrections, be sure to read this month's articles and content on www.corrections.com. For CCNN, I'm Michelle Gasso.
You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.